south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, here's something that needs to be discussed. A thing called the canasta básica, or canasta familiar. If you read Spanish or try to read Spanish, you'll see that term pop up in magazine, web articles, and newspapers once in a while. So, naturally, I get emails from gonna-bes and wannabes asking about those two sort of odd and confusing economic terms. They mean basically the same thing. A fairly precise estimate of what it would cost to feed, house, and clothe a family of four in a given Latin American country. So basically, every single Latin country has its own value for the monthly canasta básica or canasta familiar. But here's the thing, and what confuses many gringos, expats, gonna-bes, and wannabes. It's strange and a bit confusing when you see that monthly figure. For example, let's take Ecuador. And it's $715 for November 2019. Yep, $715 is what it would cost to keep a family of four in food, housing, clothing, transportation, etc. Now, of course, that's a general figure, and if you live way out in the boonies, it's a little less, and if you live in the gringified tourist areas like Cuenca, it's going to be more. Hell, if you live in Cuenca and have a decent house for a family of four, you might pay $700 a month just for rent. That is, if you like to live large. Of course, anywhere in Latin America, except in certain gringoized places like Costa Rica, Panama, etc., $700 a month will get you an awful nice place. A kind of a place the average Latino citizen could never afford. Why? Because the minimum wage is always less than the canasta básica or canasta familiar. Sometimes much less than half. That's the real conundrum. That's why I get emails from people saying, Johnny, the canasta básica or familiar in El Salvador, for example, is $540 for the month of November. They say, Johnny, I just don't get it. The minimum wage there is $346 a month. That would mean, in this case, for the average Salvadorian, with a family of four, they could never make ends meet. Same thing goes for the Ecuador example. $715 a month for the canasta básica in November, when the minimum wage in Ecuador is $400 a month. In fact, they just raised it to $400. It was slightly less than that. And considering throughout Latin America, more than half the population makes minimum wage, even less, that would mean logically that more than half of Latin Americans with a family of four can't afford the basic necessities in life. That's the conundrum. Somebody's got to be juggling the numbers or lying. Well, the numbers are true, they don't lie, but it's a fact in practically every family and household. You've got multiple people contributing to the household pot, and that kicks up the total income and puts families over the edge. In other words, for example, in Ecuador, you got dad making, let's say, $460 a month, and mom making $280 working as a cleaning lady or in a clothing factory. They've probably got their oldest kid, 11 or 12 years old, shining shoes out on the street with his little shoe shine box, and he's bringing in $80 a month. Add it all up, they're certainly not living large, but they're in the black. So that's how they pull it off. Down here, every able body in the family chips in and works. Which brings us to the educational system here in Latin America and the value that Latino families put on education. Now, as mentioned, because here in Latin America, everyone who's able to work goes out and works or does something to earn money, you'll find the university systems, both public and private, are balls to the wall busy at night and on weekends. That is, daytime attendance is much lower than evening and weekend school. That's just the opposite of what you see at universities up in the States. For one thing, up in the States, there's night school, but there really is no such thing as weekend school like there is here in Latin America. Oh, and by the way, online schools have really not caught on at all here in Latin America yet. Remember that lag time thing? It's alive and well. Just give them a time. It'll happen. Now, because weekend university classes are so popular here in Latin America, and since the weekend only has 2 days, that's why the vast majority of Latin American college students do not graduate in 4 years. Most of them take 5, 6, even 7 years to do it. And you know, even though there are many private and public universities here in Latin America, they're not cranking out big numbers of graduates as you might expect. Turns out less than a quarter of the people that attend university end up graduating. And it's been estimated that less than 3% of adult Latin Americans have a bachelor's degree or better. Whereas over one-third, that's 33% of U.S. adults, have a bachelor's degree or better, with 90% of those being useless dime-a-dozen dead-end degrees like drama, journalism, marketing, psychology, sociology, business administration, art, art history, gender studies, African-American studies, phys ed, and on and on. Turns out, and it's totally un-PC to say this, but I don't give a rat's ass, the list of degrees that have virtually no demand in the marketplace is endless. Though that's not to say those types of degrees and liberal arts degrees aren't useful in an academic sense. To read the great books and the classics and the philosophers really does help to round out a person's knowledge. But you don't need school for that. You can do that stuff on your own if you've got the initiative. And it's true, any kind of education has some value, but those kind of degrees will almost never get you a good-paying job right out of the chute. And if you have one of those dime-a-dozen degrees, you're almost guaranteed not to get a job in your chosen field. That is, unless daddy owns the company, or you happen to be a very gifted, talented, brilliant person in that field, and it really shows and everyone notices. Or you get very lucky. Right time, right place, that kind of thing. In fact, my particular situation is a perfect example of that. People ask me all the time, how'd you get into radio, Johnny? Well, guess what? I never took a media, communications, or radio TV broadcasting course. For me, it was luck. Right place, right time. Meanwhile, all the universities and colleges up in the first world are cranking out people with media and communication degrees. Now, the sad thing is, if you were to tally those graduating students 10 years later, you'll find out that only 5%, around 5 out of 100, have a job in their chosen field. The rest of them are working at banks, Home Depot, Walmart, practically anywhere other than radio, TV, and internet broadcasting. I mean, look, I have a couple of science and engineering degrees and a completely useless MBA. I remember back in college, I used to watch the kids in the business and communication schools sitting around the student union and the student lounge, watching TV, sucking down lattes, yucking it up, partying on weekends, even weeknights, coming to class with hangovers, laughing and making fun of us engineering types. And they'd say to me, Johnny, you engineering guys are way too serious. Studying all the time, hitting the labs and the books. Where's the fun in that? They'd say, man, you're doing it all wrong. Going to college is all about socializing, man, having fun. Come on, these are the best years of your life. Enjoy them. Yeah, right. Meanwhile, we, us engineers and science major types, were the ones that got great jobs right out of the chute. Meanwhile, you've got tons of people with liberal arts degrees working at Starbucks and Home Depot. Yeah, unfortunately, it's like that here in Latin America, too. Fully 90% of them take useless liberal arts degrees with a socialist slant. Now, what you'll find if you come down to Latin America and you see young people, young college graduates, making good money. Almost all of them have done so because they started their own little internet or other business. And almost all of the rest of them, the ones with liberal arts degrees, working for the man. They start off making more than minimum wage, but not a hell of a lot more. Just ask any bank teller or call center supervisor with a college degree what he or she earns a month. If it's over $600 a month U.S., I'd be very surprised. Now note, $600 a month is twice minimum wage in most Latin countries, but it still won't cover the canasta básica for a family of four in a place like Ecuador. By the way, if you're thinking that gringos and expats don't have an impact on that canasta básica, listen to this. Turns out, in the year 2008, 12 years ago now, before Ecuador became a highly popular gringo and expat destination, especially Cuenca, the canasta básica, or canasta familiar, was $200 a month. Yep, $200 a month, and now it's $715. That's something like 350% inflation in just 12 years. A disastrous amount of inflation for the average guy with a family of four. But get this. In the previous 10 years, from 1998 to 2008, that canasta básica figure of $200 did not budge. Isn't it funny? The prices jacked way up as soon as the gringos started appearing, as soon as International Living began touting the place as the perfect place for expat retirees. Then, from 2008 to 2014, it increased to $340. So 6 years ago, it was $340 a month, and now it's $715. That's about 100% inflation in 6 years. Again, directly correlating to the influx of gringos. Isn't that funny? But the good news for gringos and expats is that even at $715 a month for a family of four, that's about twice the average Social Security check. So, extrapolating that, you could make the case that, for example, a single gringo pulling down a measly Social Security check should technically be able to support a family of eight in Ecuador. So if you're up there in Cleveland living on a Social Security check, think about that when you're trying to decide, is it tuna this week or cat food? So still, even when you're on the tourist trail here in Latin America, the gringos have the advantage. Bottom line, when we pile in, we certainly drive up the prices, though in some places, much more than others. All right, let's switch gears and talk about a little boots-on-the-ground adventure in healthcare that I got personally sucked into this week. This should prove very enlightening to a lot of you out there. So pay attention. There'll be a quiz. Just a little background first. About 4 years ago, I had a pain in my upper right bicuspid, so I went to my favorite dentist in Guatemala City. He took an x-ray and showed me there was a very deep old filling in there that was leaking. So he went in there, took the filling out. Man, it was so deep. There was some residual decay right into the nerve. So when he took out all the decay, it started bleeding. He was into the nerve. Now, normally I know this for a fact because my sisters are dentists. You hit the nerve in the United States and it starts bleeding. Man, you do a root canal right away because normally the nerve will not recover from the insult. Usually within a couple of days, a week, a month, it'll act up and you'll end up with a root canal. Anyway, that's the traditional wisdom from up in the States. So generally, the dentist goes ahead and does it. Right then and there or within a day or two. Nothing fun about that, but hey, it's got to be done. And then after you've had a root canal, normally you'll need what they call a post and core. They'll stick a titanium post in the tooth, build it up to a manageable size, then do the crown. Because, you know, when you have a root canal, the dentist will tell you a tooth with a root canal will eventually dry out because there's no living material inside of it anymore. Over time, they get brittle and will fracture without a crown. And if it fractures in the wrong way, let's say vertically, you'll end up losing the tooth. And then you end up having it extracted. You want to fill the hole so you have a bridge or an implant. In other words, a lot more time, money, effort, and pain. Which is why most Americans, when faced with that, will opt for the crown right away. So let me repeat. The normal dental routine up in the States is this. If the cavity goes down to the nerve and they hit it while they're excavating and it bleeds, you end up with a root canal. And if it's a bicuspid tooth, like the tooth I was having a problem with, it's got two canals, not one like a front tooth or three like a molar. Average cost in the States for a root canal on that kind of tooth, around $1,000. Then after that, I mentioned a post and core. That's a titanium post with a buildup to make the tooth stronger. That's another $300. And after that, to protect the whole tooth, a crown on top of it. And a nice high-tech porcelain crown in the States, around $1,500. I'm talking about the ones that look absolutely natural and not like a chiclet. So let's add this up. Root canal, $1,000, post and core, $300. Crown, $1,500. Total cost for a problem bicuspid tooth like mine up in the States, close to $3,000. But that's the States. Let's talk about what happened to me here in Latin America. So about 4 years ago, I had a problem tooth. Went to my dentist in Guatemala City. He's actually an oral surgeon trained in the U.S., came back down because he has family and friends down here. So right in Guatemala City, he has a very high-level first-world dentistry practice. He's the dentist, by the way, I always recommend to people who come down to my expat insider seminars and need some dental work. In fact, many people who come to my seminar take a couple extra days just to go to the dentist. That's very easily arranged, and we help you do that. Anyway, I had a painful tooth, went to the dentist. He said, you got a huge filling in there. We're going to take it out and see what's under it. It was leaky. It had residual decay down to the nerve. It bled. I said, uh-oh, guess I'm in for a root canal. And he said, Johnny, no, it's really not necessary, not right now. I said, what? Up in the States, they'd probably do it right away, wouldn't they? I've been through that before. He said, maybe, but that's not how we do it here. I said, well, what do you do here? He says, well, we have this stuff that can calm the nerve and many times heal it. And in the majority of cases, as long as the nerve's still alive and not dead and putrid, he said, chances are the tooth will calm down and maybe you'll never have to have it worked on again. Depends how your body reacts. Who knows? You might need a root canal down the line, but it's worth a try, and we do it all the time. I said, fine, fine, go for it. And guess what? It worked, at least for the next 4 years. And then, just last week, that tooth started hurting again. But this time, I was traveling. I wasn't in Guatemala. I was in Panama with a stop in the Dominican Republic. So I did my sleuthing, found a specialist, a lady dentist who happens to be a periodontist, too. That's gum specialist. Now, the funny thing is, in Latin America, you could be a dental specialist like an oral surgeon or periodontist and still do regular dentistry. So in Latin America, most specialists do regular dentistry, too. Why? Because the general population doesn't know the difference between dental specialties. So specialists do both their specialty and general dentistry. Whereas in the States, for example, if you're an endodontist or periodontist, you stick to your specialty only. Well, it's not like that here in Latin America, because if you're a specialist here, depending only on referrals for patients, you'll probably starve. So you do everything, and your specialist work too. Confused yet? Well, you should be. So anyway, I did my sleuthing and found a very good dentist, a specialist. She opened up the tooth, saw that the nerve was truly shot, did the root canal. She put a very strong resin composite core in there and said I wouldn't need a crown. I thought, hell, that's good news. It was the kind of news I wasn't expecting. However, I know in the U.S., being that I've got dentists in the family, once a root canal is done, the dentist will almost always suggest putting a crown on it. By the way, that root canal, that would have set me back $1,000 in the States. My new lady dentist, a specialist, charged me, you ready? $80. No, not 800. $80. Yep, and she had all the latest, greatest equipment. First world office, first world technology, digital x-ray machine, the works. And when I said to her after the treatment, are we done? What's next? A crown? She said, no, I don't think so. We'll just keep an eye on it, see what happens. If in the future it needs anything else, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. So, bottom line, what are you supposed to take away from all this? Well, there's the fact that there's a different kind of philosophy going on here in Latin America when it comes to medical and dental care. In the States, as it turns out, if you've got insurance coverage, and most people do, the dentist will say, my sister included, well, you're here, so we should start the crown right now. The insurance will cover 80%, whatever. Now, that's what you call Cadillac dentistry, and the patient will almost always agree when insurance will pay most of it. In other words, the decision, though at the end it comes down to the patient and the doc, it's always guided or influenced by what the insurance will pay. And when you think about it, there's something fishy about that. And on the subject of excessive or overtreatment, my sister tells me that in her office, she has to make at least $3,000 a day to pay her help, pay all the office overhead, etc. That's stress. That's a heavy burden. She tells me her office rent alone is, get this, $10,000 a month. That's crazy, since most dentists in high-rise, first-world-style buildings here in Latin America pay $500 to, at most, $800 a month. So naturally, all physicians and dentists, no matter where they are, have to make their nut. They have to make a certain amount of money each day to stay open. With my sister, it's $3,000 a day. With the average dentist in Latin America, about $200 a day. That's a huge difference in the amount of stress and pressure you have to make your daily nut. Which is why when you look at both sides of the coin, how they do work down here in Latin America versus up in the States, it would seem that every physician and dentist up in the States would have a propensity to overtreat just to make that nut. Think about the story I just told you. Fact is, in a Nueva York or Cleveland second, I would have accepted my doctor's advice if she would have said, look, Johnny, we have to do a post and a core and do a crown on this thing right away. Up in the States, for any patient that had insurance, that would have been the routine line. Now, some might say that's excessive. It's overtreatment. It's too aggressive. That certainly would be the case as compared to here in Latin America, where most patients don't have any kind of insurance at all. And because people here in Latin America don't have insurance and don't have much disposable income, dentists and physicians are conservative in their treatment modalities. They have to be because traditionally, middle-class patients here in Latin America have very small incomes and crap credit too. So unlike up in the States, doctors make a real effort to do what's only reasonable and necessary. They're not guided by insurance companies, but by people's ability to pay. It's a whole different mindset and makes for a much nicer doctor-patient relationship all around. Fact is, I'll never forget a certain little incident that happened to me when I was back in the States many years ago, and it's got to be much worse now. You see, I was in my brother-in-law's office, an MD in Chicago, and it was around lunchtime. We were shooting the breeze, and when the clock struck one, he whispered, come here, Johnny, I want you to see something. And he opened his office door a crack. Then he said, have a look at my patients in the waiting room. I'll never forget it. Every chair was filled. Then he whispered, you know, there's $2,000 sitting there right now. Then I thought, that's not right. What a dickhead. Like I said, he's my former brother-in-law. But hey, if I had one of those guys in my own family, imagine how many jerk doctors out there right now looking at their waiting rooms and thinking the same thing. You know what I say? Three cheers for Latin American lag time. Oh, and speaking of healthcare, I've got a pleasant surprise for you. In the last few days, I've been going over, modifying, and completely revising my Latin American healthcare report. Now, you've heard me talk about that report before, and I first put it together around 4 years ago. But as of right now, my first show of January 2020, it's completely up to date and revised, including all the new stem cell stuff. So in whatever stage of your plan B you might be, even if you're just thinking about it, you really need this report. It's well over 100 pages, too. I'm certain it's the only boots-on-the-ground healthcare report of its kind. How do I know that? Well, I searched the internet high and low for this kind of material, and some of it's out there, but it's always coming from a viewpoint or a writer who's never been down here and been through the medical systems himself. All the reports I've ever seen on medical tourism and such are written by people up in the States who've gathered all their information from the net. And my report, totally based on 100% boots-on-the-ground experiences with photos to prove it. And remember, I'm not just a radio podcast guy who threw a report together. I have a degree in biomedical engineering. That means I'm an expert in medical devices, medical machinery, and medical instrumentation. I'm just a little bit more well-informed and discriminating than the average slug. At least I like to think that. So, bottom line, my completely revised, 100-page-plus Latin American healthcare report for gringos and expats is now available. You can pick up a copy, that is, get a PDF download by going to www.theexpatfiles.com, then click on Johnny's healthcare report. All right, let's take an email from Chris. He says, "Hi, Johnny. Hope you're doing well and had a great Christmas. Here's my situation. One of the projects I'm considering for my Lake Atitlan, Guatemala property is a boundary wall and or fence for privacy and security. I've got some long-ass property lines. The property is about 1.25 acres. Right now, I'm just considering my options before I get the quote from my builders. The question is a masonry block wall or poured concrete the most cost-effective? I know a stone wall would cost the most. I think the wall in front of my house is a combination of poured concrete and block. I've thought about using fencing on the back of my property where it wouldn't be quite so visible, and I don't want to skimp on the security just to save a few bucks. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, please. Especially if you have some price per unit costs. I've never heard you talk about that on your show before. Thanks a lot, Johnny. Chris, Austin, Texas. A guy who just bought a property in Lake Atitlan, the most beautiful lake in the world. Oh, and he sent me a video of the property. It's fantastic. It's got 2 houses on it, $10 million view of the lake, over an acre, and I believe he paid like $140,000 for the whole thing. Man, it doesn't seem possible in today's world, huh? But it is. Remember, we're south of the border in Plan B territory. Anyway, Chris has brought up a very good point. I don't think I've ever talked about fencing or constructing some kind of border on your property, which is something you should really consider if you've got a yard, garden, or pets anywhere in the world. Now, your longtime listeners probably know I have built something like 13 houses and offices here in Latin America. So I know more than a little bit about fencing and walls because I've built a couple of them. And here's my take on it. If you're in a nice, ecological, beautiful area like Lake Atitlan, have lots of foliage and forest and trees around you, it's a tough decision to screw up that view by putting up a kind of an institutional block or concrete wall, though they are solid and will probably outlast you. Oh, and as far as a poured concrete wall, that's kind of ridiculous and way too expensive and big overkill. Very few people do that. What people usually do when they want a big solid wall is they'll pour a footing and build a block wall and then surface it with a concrete mud kind of plaster finish or just leave the bare porous block surface, which I don't recommend because the water penetrates, it gets green, moldy, and crappy. That's why most people, at least people with class, will plant some kind of clingy vines that will eventually cover the surface inside and out, and it'll look really fantastic in a couple of years. Except having plants clinging to your walls will invite many, many bugs and insects, so be prepared for that. So if you've got such a wall and it's attached to your house or garage, you're going to have to watch out for periodic bug and ant invasions. Though if you've got a gardener or maintenance guy, that can be kept well under control. Of course, you want that wall for a couple of things. Privacy and keeping out intruders that just might see stuff you have and want to take it. It happens anywhere. And block and cement walls are a very good deterrent. And since labor is cheap, I mean really cheap, you could do an 8-foot block wall with concrete footings for a third or even a quarter of what it would cost you to do one up in the States. For example, on a property I worked on that's on about a half acre, I had an 8-foot block wall, a perimeter wall, estimated out by contractors. It was going to cost me something like $6,000. Instead, I elected to go with a cyclone or chain link fence, which priced out at less than half of that. I think it was $2,000-something. And as you know, chain link or cyclone fences aren't that secure. You can see right through them, and a guy with a wire cutters could snip them and come through at any time. Unless, of course, you've got a Doberman or a Rottweiler. They are the best deterrents, you know. If you've got one of those, no outsiders would ever attempt to come in your yard. Anyway, here's the trick. If you want to save a lot of money, have really good security. Put up an 8-foot cyclone or chain link fence with some razor wire on top. Of course, it'll look tacky or ugly at first. But wait, hear me out. Now, here in Latin America, you could buy a baby bougainvillea bush for around $3. The key is to plant one right next to every fence post, with the posts being around 8 foot apart. So let's imagine you have a square acre. That would make your plot around 200 feet on the side, or about 25 fence posts on the side if you're using 8 foot as the distance between each post. Times four, that makes 100 fence posts, or 100 little bougainvillea bushes to plant at, let's say, $3 a piece. That's $300. Now, the thing is, it'll take about 2 years before they completely cover and infiltrate the weavings between the metal spaces in the cyclone or chain link fence. But man, in the end, when they flower, they'll look absolutely beautiful. But that's not the real reason you put them there. The thing is, bougainvillea bushes, whose flowers come in, I think, 3 or 4 colors, they have some massive inch-long thorns that will certainly deter man or beast from ever trying to get through them. And they're strong and thick. Believe me, if you stick your hand in or get in a tussle with one of those bougainvillea bushes, you will pay for it dearly and come out with some pretty nasty wounds. Now, I've used that particular method of fencing in a few of the various places I've lived in, and I never had anyone attempt a home invasion, not through the bougainvillea, that's for sure. However, that means for the first 2 years, you'll have to keep an eye out because you'll be able to see through that fence, and so will people on the other side of it. That is until your bougainvillea takes off and starts thickening up. By the way, there's another kind of security fence people are building here in Latin America. It's got prefab concrete posts instead of metal ones like a chain link or a cyclone fence would have. Then you have precast 2 foot by 6 or 8 foot sections that slide into those posts which have a groove in them. So when you're done, it looks just like a solid concrete wall with a sort of fake brick pattern on it. And when you first install the things, they can look nice, but after a couple of years, they look pretty white trash and tacky. Because eventually the posts shift a little bit and the sections don't quite line up properly, start warping a little bit under their own weight because they absorb water when it rains. But it is an alternative, a lot cheaper than a block wall and just a little more expensive than a cyclone or chain link fence wall. Oh, and remember, if you have a block wall, it's going to look nice for a long time, but there will be a lot of maintenance involved if you want to keep it looking nice, especially if you end up painting it. South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.